Welcome to the Right to Food podcast. In our second episode, we bring you three different stories.
First, we talk with Irene Jackson, the new executive director of the Downtown Eastside Neighborhood House. We'll hear about her connection to the Right to Food philosophy. We'll also visit Back Alley Urban Farms in East Vancouver and find out what it takes to put a farm in your backyard. Finally, we'll listen to the voices of Poor People's Radio, who spoke out on CBC's annual Food Bank Day, December 7th. Bon appétit.
Last November, Irene Jackson became the new executive director of the Downtown Eastside Neighborhood House. Right to Food's James Kim spoke with Irene and discovered more about her connection to the Downtown Eastside, her initial challenges, and the strategic plan for the Neighborhood House.
What first attracted you to the Neighborhood House in the first place?
It was the Right to Food philosophy, hands down. The other piece was the fact that it's the Downtown East Side, and this is a community that I've worked in pretty consistently since I moved to Vancouver about 6 years ago, 6.5 years ago, and I love the community. I love the neighborhood. I love the people. I love the complexity, and I love the heart that's in the community. One of the things that has always challenged me about the Downtown East Side was the reliance on the provision of services, though. And I say the provision of services because there's a power structure that is created when a person or a group of people or indeed a community is always in the position of receiving something. I don't think that's a healthy, I don't think that's a motivating place to be. And I've had people say, you know, it's so difficult always being on the receiving end of something. You know, and my gifts and my talents and my resilience isn't necessarily acknowledged in that type of relationship. So one of the things that I really like about the Neighborhood House is that we challenge that. You know, we kind of turn that model on its ear and say there's a less power over way of working with members of this community and working with our neighbors. One that is more genuinely cooperative and egalitarian. And I love the fact that we do that using food as a mechanism to work in partnership with people and mobilize community members. You know, I love the way that access to food is so central to the work that we do. And I've worked with organizations, and the general sentiment has been, you know, our budget doesn't allow for good food or fresh food or organic food, and we just don't have the resources to provide that, and we make it happen here. I mean, we make it happen here on a shoestring. I just don't buy that.
And that certainly echoes my own experience. Everyone I've talked to, people who come to the Neighborhood House and the people who work here, that whole sense of, you know, community and we're all partners, and this is something that comes through. What sorts of things were you doing before you came to the Neighborhood House?
So most recently, I was a social worker at BC Women's Hospital in a residential treatment facility for women who have chronic, complex mental health issues and long-standing issues with substance dependence. And oftentimes people have said to me, wow, it seems like a real jump to go from a hospital, a clinical setting, into a community setting. But really, that was actually the jump. That was the jump away from community. My background was community. So making a decision to go into a clinical setting, that was kind of the quizzical one. Prior to working at BC Women's, I was the director of emergency services with Lookout, Emergency Aid Society. You know, that was robust, vibrant work in the Downtown East Side, as well as other parts of the Lower Mainland. And prior to that, I was a coordinator with Vancouver Coastal Health, managing a complex assertive case management program.
Is there anything that you would feel that you could point to? What's the most important thing that you've learned in your first month on the job?
That we're very, very different. We really go against the grain. I think we do work in a way that others would see as being almost impossible. That's incredibly powerful to me, that we challenge that charity model, that idea that members of our neighborhood and our neighbors cannot truly act in partnership. We do that every day, and I'm reminded every day of how different that is. There's a real beauty and justice in the way that we do things, that provides other options, that provides a bit of a choice for people. I love my learning around that.
Is there a flip side? Like, do you encounter any sort of any unexpected challenges after you started here?
Well, I've never been an executive director before, so that on its own is a huge learning curve. There are facility issues that are new to me. How much power we need for our new industrial dishwasher and so on. And I'm just starting to get a handle on.
Is there a way that you usually start your day here?
Every day is different. I don't have an answer, for that. There's a fair bit of administrative work. A good chunk of my time so far has been trying to get a handle on sort of the lay of the land, where we are financially. And so every day has that thread through it, for sure. The other consistent piece is looking for funding. And I see that being in the future as well. It's something that's always on the table.
Where do you hope to see the neighborhood house in, let's say, 1 year's time?
I'd like us to really have some more financial stability. I think that we're definitely moving in the right direction, and I don't mean to imply that we're financially unstable. I would love to have some core funding. I would love to work with the board and the members of the community and our staff team on developing a plan, a strategic plan, on where we all see the neighborhood house in a few years' time. Hopefully in the next year, I'll be able to spend time with the community to find out what our neighbors want our neighborhood house to look like.
So is there a strategic plan right now, or not so much?
There is, but we have a plan that really looks at some broad strokes. I think that it would benefit us and the neighborhood and the community to really bring that down to some very specific steps and some very specific actions.
Outside of the neighborhood house, you must have some kind of life.
So I coordinate the Extreme Weather Response Program for the City of Vancouver, which is connected to homelessness. So when the weather is very, very bad, there's an entire system that sort of is mobilized for people to bring them in off the streets. So in the winter time, that's something that takes a fair bit of time. I spend a lot of time chatting with my family and staying connected with my family. My sister has two teenagers, and I never talk to them on the phone. I only ever text them. We have a great, very close relationship via text, and that warms my heart. I have to watch Glee every week in order to sustain the relationship with my nieces. And I'm learning how to ski. I've never been downhill skiing. I was an avid cross-country skier growing up. One of my nieces was recently hired, and she was hired as a ski instructor. It's her first job ever. She was kind of my inspiration to learn how to ski. Thought, oh, you know, better late than never. As long as I don't tear my knees apart.
Is there anything else you would like to say that we haven't talked about?
Just that it's such a privilege. Just that it's such a privilege to be here. I love waking up and doing work, you know, air quotes around that, because to me it's not. And I think I'm one of a fortunate few who can say that. But yeah, I think it's a privilege to be working with this team and to learn from this team and to learn from members of the community.
In a pen in East Vancouver, there are four hens that are Vancouver-born and raised. These hens are part of Back Alley Urban Farms and are living proof that localized food production is not only possible, it's happening in a backyard near you. Right to Food's John Hughes spoke with Kim Del Valle Garcia and Rowan Melling, the people behind Back Alley Urban Farms.
Well, these are my chickens, and we actually bought them from another urban farmer who unfortunately was kicked off of her property and had to move. So we bought them from her, so they are Vancouver born and raised. They're, how old are they now? About 8 months old? They're about 8 months old now. Almost a year. And we've had them since August, and we have them for eggs. So we get probably during the summer they'll each lay about an egg a day, so that's 3 to 4 eggs a day. During the winter it's probably quite a bit less, it's maybe an egg a day. Right now they haven't been laying too much because the weather's quite cold and kind of yucky. They live off of a diet of just kind of anything. They're omnivores, so you can feed them anything you have. They'll eat meat. They'll eat scraps. We make sure to throw them pellets, so they have a constant supply of pellets, so they're getting all of their nutrients, as well as some chicken scratch, so that has some other vitamins, and we'll just kind of toss that as a treat to them. But other than that, they're quite easy. We actually got chickens because we wanted, number one, we wanted eggs. I'm a vegan except for their eggs, so it's nice to have. And we also wanted their fertilizer for around the property because fertilizer can be quite expensive and tricky to get. So if we have it right here, then it's great. And as you can see right here, we have a large pile of their straw and hopefully some of their shit that we can compost and then use as fertilizer.
It might strike listeners as unusual that there are chickens that are not being sort of hunted down by the man. What is the law, as you understand, the bylaw in Vancouver for keeping chickens?
It's perfectly legal to have chickens. You can have up to 4 chickens. You cannot have roosters because roosters are quite noisy. And you can't have chicks. So they want them to be at least 6 months old. I think it's six months old that they have to be. They don't want the chicks because they don't want a breeding facility going on in the city. But other than that, it's perfectly legal. So what we have is Back Alley Urban Farms, and we take any usable space that we can, whether it's legal or illegally, and we use that space to grow food. The major goal is to be able to feed the local community. This year we had 2 plots that we grew off of, and this is the main one in the backyard here, and we managed to feed ourselves quite nicely, and we're still feeding ourselves throughout the summer. And we also were selling, we sold at some farmers markets. The Carousel Farmers Market was one of them that we sold at, and we also established a farm gate, so we were actually selling from this property to local residents. So people would just kind of put up a sign, people would walk by, price of things, and we developed a pretty good relationship with a lot of our neighbors who would constantly come back to buy vegetables.
And so the total number is 4 plots that you have?
Right now we've got 3 that we're working with, though we're getting kicked off of 1 for next year, and we're working on establishing another one. So we're looking on expanding and trying to get some more for next year. So the number right now is 3, but we're hoping to.
And don't you have one at a school someplace?
Yeah, so my roommate is a Montessori preschool teacher, and they have a very small plot in downtown Vancouver, and they've asked us to put in a garden more as an educational thing for the kids than a market garden or growing for market.
It's pretty easy to grow food and pretty rewarding, and you know, a yard like this, it's not all that big and we can feed ourselves on it, so I mean, I think the time you spend working for money and then translating that money into food, you could spend a lot less time and more meaningful time growing your own food. And once you no longer have to pay money for your means of subsistence, if that's possible, then you no longer really have to work, for capital.
Tell me what the kind of work that goes into this. How long does it take to keep these farms going?
It's hard to say. It's like a totally different kind of work than job work. It's much more spaced out, I find. It's kind of like you go out in the garden and you look around and you're like, oh, that needs doing, and you do that, and it's much more of a flow going on, but it's still, I can put in like a day of work, but almost without realizing I've put in a day of work, you know.
How would you describe the stress level of working in a garden versus, say, a 9-to-5 punch clock job?
Oh, man. Working in the garden is so mellow. It's like, it really relaxes me, whereas working a 9-to-5 job is not very fun for me. I have back problems, and like, I work as a gardener even, and it's fine. It's okay work, but, this is super mellow and much more like, you get in among the plants and wander around, hanging out with birds and stuff is cool.
I think that the food system as it is obviously faulty. We have local farmers who cannot afford to grow food, local farmland that is being developed, and we have people that are starving in the city. So it's pretty obvious that we need to change the food system as it is. And we have so much land here that is usable, that can be used for farming amongst many, many other things in the city. So it's a matter of diversifying the food system. And this is just one of the prongs. I mean, this is not going to replace our large-scale farms out in the country. It's just an addition to it, and it's something that people in the city should just be doing. I mean, there's no reason why you can't have a farm in your backyard. And I mean, not everybody has the time and the ability to have a farm in their backyard, but then that's where people, other members of the community like us, could probably step in and lend them a hand to growing their own food.
About 80 low-income people gathered on Vancouver's CBC on its annual Food Bank Day to say that they want governments to end the need for food banks by raising welfare rates. Right to Food's Peter Driftmeyer recorded some of that event.
Organized by Raise the Rates, the group set up its own tent on the CBC Plaza and ran Poor People's Radio for an hour. The show was hosted by Lorna Bird and Paul Taylor and gave people living in poverty an opportunity to speak out. In 1982, the Greater Vancouver Food Bank Society was established as a temporary social service. Now, 30 years later, it has become a permanent institution to help many of the hungry people in BC. During this time, the value of social assistance payments have steadily declined. Today's $610 per month income would be over $900 if rates kept pace with inflation. That 50% difference over the past 30 years has direct correlation to the entrenched permanence of food banks in BC. Now you'll hear the group setting up their impromptu radio setup and start their broadcast. This is Poor People's Radio.
Justice, not charity!
Justice, not charity!
Raise the rates now!
Raise the rates now!
Justice, not charity!
Justice, not charity!
Raise the rates now!
Raise the rates now!
When do we want it?
Now!
Okay, everyone, come on in and gather around, gather around. So we're going to, today, we're here at our public broadcaster, CBC, so you're all owners of this radio station. So I don't really understand why they're trying to prevent us from setting up and having our say on their open house day. So I'd now like to officially hand it over to Paul Taylor and Lorna Bird, the hosts of Poor People's Radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, hello and welcome to 88.1.10, Poor People's Radio. I'm here with the lovely Lorna Bird. Lorna, will you tell us why we're here today?
Well, trying to raise the rates. I was here last year, and I wrote a big paper that shows how much everything is, your rent, your bus fare, all the different stuff, your phone. And by the time it got down to the money, I think there was, I think you were allowed a couple of meals or something. And anyway, so you couldn't even afford to buy salt or pepper.
All right. First, we want to hear from more people who are struggling, trying to make ends meet on welfare and disability, and who have to try to rely on food banks and the food lineups each and every day. First, I'd like to ask our first guest, Richard, to come on out, please. Richard.
Yay, Richard.
And welcome to 88.1.10, Richard.
Richard, what is it like to use the food banks to meet your basic nutritional needs?
I am quite discouraged when I go to my food bank because I'm one of these people who's been living with HIV for over 25 years. I'm a survivor of that. And to go and get canned goods that are expired, things that I can't eat with because I don't have any teeth, and just, you know, just feeling less than who I am. But it's going to stop. And it has to stop now. I think that, food banks are all right. I appreciate it. I thank God for it. But at the same time, I really wish that they didn't have them. There's no reason to have them when we got a rich economy like Canada, one of the richest in the world. And we treat our people worse than we do to visitors. And that has to stop as well. But the biggest thing that I want to say is, come on, raise the rates. You know, if you raise the rates, we won't have any more ghettos. Thank you.
Thanks, Richard. Where are you?
Okay.
Here's Marilyn. I'm going to ask you first, I'll ask you these questions and then see if you can answer. So what is it like to have to use the food banks to meet your basic nutritional needs?
Well, to start with, it's quite a ways out of my way to even go to a food bank because there's none in the area. And to have to wait in those long lineups when I have arthritis so badly. And then they have food that's out of date, and most of it's noodles and things that, like little condiments that I can't use. And I mean, I have Hep C, and I have to watch my diet, and they just don't fill my nutritional needs. And yet I can't get anything extra from social services to help.
Do food banks help poor people to live with dignity and feel empowered and able to fully participate in society?
No, they don't. Actually, what they do is they deprive people of their sense of dignity, because to take away the fact that you would be able to buy your own food and you have to grovel more or less for 2 or 3 hours in a lineup just to go through and get one little bag of groceries that half of them you can't use anyway. No, it degrades people more than anything, and it makes you feel more isolated from the general public.
Thank you very much, Marilyn. Thank you. I've just heard today that if you don't have an address, you can't go to the food banks either.
I think what we're hearing from everyone today is quite different from what we're hearing inside there, or what the folks who are in there are hearing. And what folks who are in there are hearing are they're hearing that how generous it is that people are coming down and donating to food banks and not asking those questions as to why it is that we live in a wealthy country that continues to have food banks. This is the discussion with our friends and neighbors here that we're having out here that we would urge the CBC to have, and we have urged the CBC to have, inside there. It's unfortunate that we have to be out here having this discussion, but we will continue to do so until it's being had in there.
Okay, I'm going to... We're going to hear from somebody that has a child and lives on welfare. Here's Stacy.
Hi, I'm actually a widowed mother with 2 children, and I live on welfare at this point in time. Every month I get $1,035. 610 of that goes to my rent, and I live in BC Housing. That leaves me with $416 to buy clothes, food. I have a special needs child who has a special diet. I can't live on that, so obviously we go to the food bank. I'm not saying the food bank's a bad thing, but if you gave us more than $416, my boys wouldn't be running around with holes in their shoes right now in the rainy days, because I could buy them if I had more than $400, but that's what we eat on. So this is the reality. The rates need to be raised to a livable rate, and standing in the lineups at the food bank with little kids is not fun. It's embarrassing. It's frustrating. They're hungry. They're cold. They're tired. And you have to stand there and wait to get with half the food you probably won't even use because it's outdated. Sorry, food bank, but you do give out a lot of outdated food. The cans are bent. The food isn't good. We can't live on pasta. Why do you think poor people are fat? All they eat is carbohydrates. It's not because they're pigs. It's because we don't eat healthy diets. So pay attention to what we're saying and have a little talk to your MLAs. Raise the welfare rates.
Thank you, Stacy. Next, we'd like to call on the organizer for the Raise the Rates Coalition, Bill Hopwood. Bill, come on down, Bill.
Bill, where are you? Here comes Bill. Now.
Bill, welcome to 88.1.10.
Need a hand up.
Okay.
Not a hand.
Hi. Food banks in BC were set up 30 years ago, and the people who set them up said it was a temporary measure. 30 years is not temporary. If you went to the doctor 30 times and all they did was treated your symptoms and never treated the cause, you would change your doctor. Hunger is a symptom. The cause is poverty. The cure for poverty is raising welfare, raising the minimum wage, and as Ayanna said earlier, tax the rich. The BC government has given away $3 billion a year in tax cuts to the rich, which they have stolen from the people of British Columbia, from welfare, from health, from education. People say we can't afford to raise welfare. Poverty in BC costs the people of BC $8 billion a year in health costs, in medical costs, in education costs. It would cost less to fix it than it does cost us to pay for poverty. The one difference, the difference is we pay for poverty and the rich benefit from poverty. So we're subsidizing the rich by our poverty.
We still pay taxes
too. And we pay as well. So that's why we need a change to raise welfare, to raise minimum wage. And there was one other thing I wanted to say. Oh, Gene said if they raise $500,000 a day. Well, if they raise $500,000 today, that would be $5 for every child in poverty in BC. $5 for a year from charity. Charity will never solve the problem. People are generous. Why is the government so mean and cold-hearted? They have no heart. People have heart. We want justice. Justice, not charity.
Justice, not charity.
Raise the rates now.
And that was a selection of Voices from Poor People's Radio, which took place as an action on the front steps of the Vancouver CBC Open House fundraiser for the Vancouver Food Bank last week. The action was organized by Raise the Rates to provoke public discussion missing from the CBC's content that day about the inability of charities to address poverty in BC. If you'd like more information on the Raise the Rates Coalition, you can visit raisetherates.org.
Thanks for joining us for the Right to Food podcast. I'm James Kim.
I'm Ricky Chen. We'd love to hear what you think. Music for this podcast was provided by Mocha Only. The song is called Salt. You can email us at zine@dtesnhouse.ca. If you want to check out the online version of the zine and look for upcoming podcasts, visit us at dtesnhouse.ca/zine. See you at the Neighborhood House. We'll